Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 244th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is one of the most talented and versatile actors in the business, a man who first made his name on two comedic TV programs, Comedy Central's The Daily Show from 1999 through 2004, and NBC's The Office from 2005 through 2011, and who has also done outstanding work in films of all sorts, from comedies like 2003's Bruce Almighty, 2004's Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy, 2005's The 40-Year-Old Virgin, and 2011's Crazy Stupid Love, to dramedies like 2006's Little Miss Sunshine, 2007's Dan in Real Life, 2012's Hope Springs, 2013's The Way, Way Back, 2015's The Big Short, and 2017's Battle of the Sexes and Last Flag Flying, to straight-up dramas like 2014's Foxcatcher, and, most recently, Beautiful Boy, a film unveiled at September's Toronto International Film Festival and released in theaters Friday by Amazon that was adapted from the true story of a man, played by Carell, fighting to help his son, played by Oscar nominee Timothée Chalamet, as the son becomes ensnared by addiction. I'm talking, of course, about the once Oscar-nominated, six-time Emmy-nominated, eight-time SAG Award-nominated, and nine-time Golden Globe-nominated, and one-time Golden Globe-winning, Steve Carell. Over the course of our conversation at the London West Hollywood Hotel, the 56-year-old and I discussed a wide range of topics, including how improvisational comedy became an early passion, how he wound up at The Daily Show and why he decided to make himself the butt of his jokes while there, how his small part in Anchorman led to his movie star-making part in The 40-Year-Old Virgin, which, in turn, saved the fledgling American adaptation of Ricky Gervais's hit British sitcom The Office, and what initially motivated and continues to motivate him to branch out beyond comedy and into darker material, including Foxcatcher, which resulted in that aforementioned Best Actor Oscar nomination, and continuing through Beautiful Boy, which could result in another. But first, I was joined at the offices of The Hollywood Reporter by the Emmy-winning TV host, author, and First Lady of the great state of New York, Sandra Lee, who is the subject and producer of a powerful new HBO documentary short, which is eligible for the Best Documentary Short Oscar, called RX Early Detection, A Cancer Journey with Sandra Lee, which debuted on HBO on Monday night and is now available on demand. Sandra, I feel like we are old pals at this point, even though I only met you yesterday because I had the opportunity to watch this very powerful movie right next to you and with all of your, you know, a lot of your friends and family, because you're from LA until about 8 years ago. What was that like for you last night, this LA unveiling of the movie?
It was a very emotional premiere for me, and it continues to be so today. But we were lucky enough to be at Sundance and then at Tribeca, which is incredible. And my family had never seen it. I have done a couple premieres, but my family hadn't seen it. So my wonderful family was in the room, and it made it extra special and super emotional for me. I was just grateful to be there.
So can you paint a picture for people who haven't yet seen the film of what your life was like generally, but also very specifically on the day that in 2015 you found out you had breast cancer?
Well, you know, I spend my life either shooting television shows that are how-to shows, whether it's food or home or crafts or gardening. And then I shoot my magazine, which is either food or home or crafts or gardening, something. But that particular day, I was really lucky that People Magazine was shooting me for their World's Most Beautiful in May of 2015 was the pub date for that. And I was in my apartment dressed in all white with my two beautiful birds. I have cockatoos that I love. They're my babies. You saw Phoenix. He's like a little boy. And I had gone for my mammogram earlier that week.
And it just was a routine.
Just routine mammogram. And they said they saw something that was different than the years before. So they wanted me to get it checked out. And I had a biopsy 2 days later. Mm-hmm. And then on Friday at 5, the phone rang. I had just walked off the set of that photo shoot. And if you've ever been on anything that has to do with People Magazine, it's full hair, full makeup, full. Looks nothing like I look. I can look like me or Cher in the same 2 hours. I say that all the time.
Right.
Me or Cher, same 2 hours. It is almost Halloween.
Right.
And they called and told me that I had breast cancer.
And they tell you that over the phone or they tell you to come into the doctor's office?
No, they told me on the phone. Said I didn't want you to wait for the weekend to wonder, which was a real gift. Mm-hmm. A real gift because that weekend, Emperor of All Maladies by the king of documentaries, Ken Burns, mm-hmm. was the king and queen of documentaries have come into my world. But yes. The king of documentaries, Ken Burns, had Emperor of All Maladies playing in rotation on PBS. So I had the pleasure of watching that in rotation all weekend long on PBS. And if you've ever seen that, it's really kind of the history of what happened. The people who came before us, the women who suffered and who were science projects and happily so just to gain a week or two or a year of life when they were diagnosed, but also the scientists and the doctors who have given up their lives so that we might have early detection. But cancer, breast cancer, any kind of cancer, it's not about that specific type of cancer. And this is the most important thing I can say. Forget about breast cancer. Forget about colon cancer. Forget about cancer. Cancer is cancer. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter what type you have and where it's at. It is not there to be your friend. So watching that and understanding the history and thinking about all the people who have suffered in history with this awful disease and the people who suffer now mm-hmm. was a really clear message for me of what I had to be. And that was as aggressive with cancer as cancer was going to be with me. Cancer is there to kill you. It's not there to be your friend.
And pretty soon after that, you decided to document this what is probably the worst period of your life as a film. And I wonder, you're, again, somebody that people generally see out in the, if they know you, it's because they see you as a very polished person on TV or in magazines or, you know, in controlled settings where you are very put together with what you're doing. And
I call it edited into perfection.
There you go.
Which is an unrealistic way to live, but it depends on what your messaging is in that moment.
Right. And, you know, you've done it very well. It wasn't just that. That wasn't the only year you were one of People Magazine's 50 Most Beautiful. I think it's been several years. You've also, as we said, been recognized with Emmys and other accolades and things like that. So that's the default setting. Now you're going to let cameras in to a very vulnerable situations where you don't know where it's going. What made you decide to do that?
Information. And two reasons. First and foremost, you know, when you see me in my career, it is about tablescapes and meals and cocktails and beautiful homes and decor and matching outfits and all of those things. That is a part of life. But the other part of life is disease and loss and living your day-to-day reality. And it isn't pretty every single day. But my job in the world and my purpose on this planet is to, I believe, is to give as much information as I can with what I'm given. And so I believe in what Robin Roberts believes in, and that is make your mess your message. So when I was raised on welfare and food stamps, and I know the grocery store better than anyone else on this planet, I believe, and all those brands, I made it into a cooking show. And I said, okay, people, if you're going to do it this way, here's how you do it to the best of your ability. And when God gave me a cancer diagnosis, I'm like, okay, well, it's not going to be beautiful cinematography. It's not going to be audio packs. There's not going to be any lighting, and there's not going to be any makeup or hair. But this is what I could not find for myself. I couldn't find what the disease looked like. I couldn't find what it was going to look like when I decided to get a double mastectomy. I couldn't find any information that I felt I needed. So my sister and I, and she was my caregiver, we created it. It is a tool and a resource for people who either have been through it, are going through it, or who will go through it, and their caregivers and their family and friends to understand what it looks like and what your loved one is living through. And it's not pretty.
No.
It is not pretty. It is gutty and it is gritty and it is not pretty, but it is the truth.
So how logistically did the filmmaking side of this work? Did you just always have cameras around you or how did it work?
There's one little tiny handheld camera.
Yeah.
It was such an old camera that the tapes had to come. The only place that supplied them was Best Buy and we had a special order them. I mean, I have to say, a year and a half later, when I walked in with these tapes, and that was the only thing we had,
yep.
And I walked into the queen of documentary, Sheila Nevin's yes. office, who was kind enough to take a meeting. And 2 hours later, all I had were these tapes. And she said, I don't think we're going to do this documentary. And I said, I don't even know if I have one. Mm-hmm. But what I know is I have a lot of tape. There's content in here that people will use. It will save lives. There's a purpose for this. And it will make families understand. And that is what this is about. And she said, okay, well, Andrew's in it, the governor of the state of New York.
Right.
So we can't just put it in our normal system. So what I'll do is I'll give you the equipment.
Right.
You find the editor. You figure out what you want to do and bring me something if you feel you even have it.
Interesting.
So I did.
Yeah.
And I sat with her and I watched it for the first time together. And I sat there crying.
Mm-hmm.
And she started to cry.
Mm-hmm.
And she looked at me and she said, all right.
good impression.
If yeah. you are really going to do this.
Right.
And you're really comfortable showing what you just showed me, and you have to make that decision because this is not how people think perceive you.
Right.
And I said, yeah, but that's not reality anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That's a show. It's a different thing. Mm-hmm. And she said, if you're willing to do this, I will do it with you. But this is going to be something different than, and you can never go back.
Right.
And I don't want to go back. I want people to live.
Right.
I want people to know, and I want people to go out and get early detection.
Well, I'm glad that she had that change of heart because she, you know, it was interesting. We did an episode with her maybe a year or two ago for the same podcast, and to understand how many pitches she gets and things that don't come to fruition or even things that they want to do that just they can never quite bring together. And it's a major testament to the film itself, any film that gets made there. And it was probably one of the last ones that she was associated with during her tenure there. She's now moved on. But how did the Oscar-winning actress Kathy Bates become one of the executive producers of this film? Is that somebody that you knew before?
I didn't. Mm-hmm. You know, cancer is a very interesting disease. It brings people together in a brotherhood and a sisterhood that is just different. And until you are told that you have cancer, that your family member who you love more than anything has cancer, it's just, you go, I don't want to hear about it anymore. And I was one of those people. I went to a fundraiser at a private home in New York, mm-hmm. and she suffers from lymphedema, which is a very painful disease, and she's going to have it for the rest of her life.
Having already had
ovarian
and breast
and
cancer with a double mastectomy, I mean, it's unbelievable. People don't know this about her. They just see her in every American Horror Story thing, or they remember her from Misery. This talk about misery. This is unbelievable. Right?
Well, I'm going to say this
yeah.
only because it is in Style magazine, as they call them, and it's called Badass Women.
Yeah.
She should be the cover of it.
Oh, yeah.
No. Because she lays it down every day in her advocacy for other people's health. She lays it down every single day on her show
mm-hmm.
when she is in her performance and in life. She's just one of those incredible women that is a force of nature. So when I met her, she explained to me what was going on with lymphedema, and nobody told me when I had made the decision that I made what the outcome could be for me. I didn't get lymphedema, but she did, and a lot of people do. And if you count all the people
mm-hmm.
that have it, it is something like 7 different major diseases that we hear about every day combined.
Can you explain for people who don't know what lymphedema is, what it does to you?
Well, it's in your lymphatic system and it causes problem with drainage and it causes severe pain and swelling. And,
yeah.
You know, it happens to men if they have, you know, prostate, which is related to breast,
right.
and it comes out of their legs, the lymph nodes. And for women, it's in your arms and in your armpits.
And that can happen as a result of the mastectomy.
Or any, yeah, procedure
wow.
on cancer. It happens with a lot of cancer patients. You know, we all know there's like 2 things that are going to kill you. It's either going to be cancer or heart disease, unless you get in a car accident.
Right.
This is called RX Early Detection, a cancer journey with Sandra Lee for a reason. It's not a breast cancer journey with Sandra Lee. Right. It is a cancer journey with Sandra Lee. RX means recipe for. So this is it. RX is a recipe for early detection. It's the best way to save your life. Now I'm going to give you a statistic.
Yeah, please.
So if you're talking about breast, it's what, 1 in 8 women. If you're talking about other cancers, it's 1 in 6 people. Whatever you're talking about, there's always an equation. And this is the most important thing we can say. So let's just say you and I are sitting here and you're going to go out and get in your car and you have a 1 in 6 chance of getting in an auto accident or a 1 in 10 chance, or your child is going to leave the house and has a 1 in 6 or a 1 in 10 chance of getting in a car accident and may or may not be fatal. So you're going to put as many airbags in your baby's car as you can. All right. Early detection is that. And it's completely doable if you just go in and get your screenings. Whatever your screenings are, whatever your checkups are, stay on your body. You want to stay on the planet. We want you to stay. We want to be together.
Well,
we're going to be going soon enough. None of us are getting out of here alive.
No.
Get your checkup.
Well, and this, though, is where the documentary leads to advocacy for what you guys are, I think, planning to focus on moving forward is that, you know, it's easy to say everybody should get a mammogram, but if insurance doesn't cover it, which for a lot of people it doesn't, I think I heard it's like $900. A lot of people can't, they can only go in and get it during working hours, which is not very helpful for working class people who don't have flexible hours. So what are some of the things? I know already in the state of New York, Andrew's introduced some legislation, and he said that just as a result of people in his own office knowing about what you went through, 3 young women went and got mammograms, and all 3 came back with breast cancer, which is unbelievably frightening, but also you may well have already saved their lives before the film was even seen. But now it comes to legislation. So what has he been able to do? What else needs to happen around the country?
Okay, so there's a couple things. First and foremost, let's talk about cancer on a whole. 90% of the time, there is no family history. Every doctor will tell you, and that's one of the things you're going to see in this documentary. You're going to see from the first time I write the words breast cancer on the document or cancer, forget about breast, it's all cancer. From the first time you write cancer on a document all the way through my surgery, you're in the operating room, and I know we were together when we saw that scene. It was intense. It's all the way through the post-surgical infection, all the time in the hospital, all the intimate moments. So I implore everybody to just take 38 minutes out of their life and look at this short so you understand what it is.
Yeah.
The second thing. So 90%, no history in the family. It's the environment. Every doctor says they don't know if it's the air meets the water, meets the food, meets the hairspray, meets the whatever, your antiperspirant, your shaving cream, doesn't matter. It's a combination that's changing our cells. All cancer is just a cell gone bad, and then gone rogue. That's what it is. And then it hides itself. The epidemic, if you look at colon, men just came out yesterday, I think, men in their 20s and 30s, epidemic with men in their 20s and 30s, colon and rectal cancer. With women, breast, 30s and 40s. It's an epidemic. And we're not even advising people to get screened until they're 45. That is a death sentence.
Yeah.
You do not want that for your children, and you shouldn't want it for yourself. So what we have in our state for breast specifically, but I'd love to see other cancers rolled up into this bill. And we just passed a bill for lymphedema as well. So now that's law.
Yep.
It's required that you tell people. But when it comes to the no excuses law, there's a lot of reasons why people don't go in and get their screenings. 2 most important reasons, in my opinion, are time and money. Everything breaks down to time and money. First, let's talk about money. Copays and deductibles, if you have insurance, couldn't be as high as $800-$900 for your copay or your deductible. In our state, we require the insurance companies to pay the copay. Your screening costs zero.
That's
now,
right.
If you don't have money, there's zero anyway because you're going to go to a free clinic. Mm-hmm. But if you have insurance, a lot of people are deciding, do I pay for heat for my family for December, January, and February, or do I go get my screening, which I may or may not have something?
Right.
How do you make that decision to feed your family for 2 months?
So that's already
or get a
passed
screening?
In New York. That's fantastic.
That's
wow.
passed.
Yeah.
That's done. And the second thing is time. 9 to 5, when the hospitals or clinics are open, the governors have control of the hospitals and clinics. So an hour at lunch is not enough time. We leave a majority of our hospitals and clinics, like 200, open late at night and on the weekends to accommodate your schedule. So now there's no money issues, there's no time issues, there's no excuses for you not to get your screening.
Right.
Every governor in this union has to lay that law down.
Obviously, that kind of legislation still needs to be adopted in a lot of other states because the numbers still, I saw 113 people dying every day from breast cancer, which is just not acceptable. So I guess as a, you know, to wind this down, how are you feeling now? And does your motto from the film, which I'll leave it to you to share, does that still apply? Does that still get you through? There was something that you would repeat and people around you would repeat while you were going through this.
Cured and beautiful.
Yes.
Everybody is a beautiful being, in my opinion. If you are life on earth, you're beautiful. So one of the things we always want to remember when cancer is in our world is who's ever got it, we just want you cured and beautiful. We just want you whole. The goal is to take this out to the other governors and to have it passed in their states. I'm going to the states that I'm from first. So I've already talked to Gavin, please, sweet God.
California governor-to-be, hopefully.
Please, God.
Yes.
And I talked to Inslee in Washington State.
Yep.
I was raised here. I started my company here in my aunt and uncle's home in a small bedroom in San Fernando Valley. And I am a New Yorker, but a California girl.
Right.
And so those are my first two states. Washington is next. And then I got to go to Wisconsin because that's where I was schooled.
Already taking care of New York. So that's they're adding up. It's great. One by one.
Yep.
Well, as somebody who, like everybody, has a personal connection to this, my grandmother died of cancer of the uterus. Another very close and loved relative is currently dealing with stomach cancer. It's horrible. I think that something like this is so important, and I really appreciate that you made the film and that you came to talk about it. So thank you, Sandra Lee.
Thank you, Scott.
And now for my interview with Steve Carell. Steve, thank you so much for doing this. I appreciate it. We always begin with just a few basics. Where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
I was born in Concord, Massachusetts. And my dad was a heat transfer engineer, and my mom was a psychiatric nurse.
Okay. I read you are the youngest of four boys, and one of the articles I came across suggested that one of the things, because there was a bit of an age difference, that one of the things you guys bonded over was the Three Stooges.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting because it seems like from the way this piece framed it, your comedic sensibility maybe might have been hinted at by the Stooges that you gravitated towards.
I liked Larry.
Yeah.
I always thought Larry was the funniest because he was always sort of in the background and he never seemed to be trying too hard. And there was something I liked about that.
Yeah.
Obviously, I thought Curly was hilarious and Mo was kind of the glue, but Larry was a bit of a wild card.
Right.
I like that.
So growing up, was comedy a primary interest of yours? Were you a big consumer of it? Were you yourself the class clown or whatever?
I was a consumer, but I wasn't the class clown. Mm-hmm. I didn't know. I would buy comedy albums, and I followed in my brother's footsteps, too. They listened to a lot of National Lampoon and Firesign Theater, and we'd all bond over those things, too. We'd all sit and listen to kind of a bygone era. Mm-hmm. We'd sit and listen to comedy albums, and starting with George Carlin, and I had all of Steve Martin's mm-hmm. albums. And at the time, I didn't realize it, but I was studying just by listening, especially Steve Martin. I'd listen to him over and over and over, and his comedy was so different than anyone else's because it was very absurdist. It was kind of anti-comedy. And I was taken with the fact that he would tell these jokes that didn't really have a punchline or a punchline that you would expect turned into something else. And I would try to figure out why I thought it was so funny. At the time, as a kid, I'd just be listening to it in order to laugh again. But I think in retrospect, I realized I was really studying those things.
But in terms of your own outlook for your own future, going through high school, going through college, it wasn't even a thought that this would be a career path for you, right? I understood you were doing plays and things in high school, in college. I guess you got involved with improv for the first time in college, but you were doing the responsible thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, my trajectory was law school. That's mm-hmm. really what I thought I'd end up doing. And the other stuff was just fun. Mm-hmm. It was extracurricular. You know, I played a lot of sports and I was on student council and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And part of that was doing theater and plays. But comedy itself didn't seem like, you know, where my head was at all.
Just improv specifically, though, it sounds like Denison, where you went to college, has the oldest improv comedy group there. Is that right?
And that's the claim.
Well, so, I mean, improv obviously ended up being a big part of your life. That was the seed of the interest for you there?
It was. A friend of mine, and we both decided to go down and audition, and I didn't really know anything about improv. I'd never really taken any improv classes, so the whole idea kind of scared me, but we thought that might be fun to do. And it was very low-key. It was a student-run improv group, and you could only audition when you were a freshman. They didn't audition anybody else, so you kind of became a lifer. Mm-hmm. Once you got in as a freshman, then you would go through the entire your college career as part of the group, and they still do that to this day. But no, it wasn't really on my radar before that.
And so you did that all the way through, but you were also doing, and this may be news to some people, you were also doing Shakespearean stuff. You're doing other dramatic stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it wasn't like you yourself had a clear idea at that point, I'm a guy that's going to be a comedy person. It sounds like it was very fluid.
I actually didn't think it would be comedy. I didn't think that would be my way in, because the thought of doing stand-up was terrifying.
Really?
To me. Oh, yeah, there's no way I could do that. And I knew at the time. I saw people like Steve Martin and George Carlin. I saw what they did, and I just didn't possess that kind of ability. And I didn't really think about comedy career-wise. I really didn't think about acting career-wise at that time. I just thought, this is a fun thing to do, even in college, but I'm still going to go to law school.
What changed that?
It was my application to law school, which there was an essay question that asked, why do you want to be an attorney? And I couldn't answer it. I just had no idea. There was no good answer.
Right.
So then I decided to take a detour and move to Chicago. But even then, I just thought acting. There was whatever I could get, whatever I could be hired to do, that was the idea.
So how then, once you were in Chicago, did you, which I guess has always, or for a long time, been associated with comedy and improv, is that the reason there was just more of it there? That's how you ended up in that more at Second City, and also, you know, doing a variety of other things while there? Like, what led you down the comedy route once you were there?
Well, Chicago as a city seemed much less intimidating than New York or LA for a young actor. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to work, and I figured it's a smaller pond, mm-hmm. so maybe the availability just to work. And I wasn't looking. I thought, well, you move to LA if you're ready, mm-hmm. or you move to New York if you're ready, or you want to be discovered. I wasn't looking to be discovered. I just wanted to get some experience under my belt. So I thought Chicago might be the best place to do that. And it wasn't even about making any money at it, just to get up on stage and learn. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Second City was there was also a draw. I'd seen Second City when I was in college, and I thought, boy, that would be a fun job to have, touring around doing improv. The whole comedy thing happened just by virtue of the parts that I started to get. You know, I auditioned for things, and I consistently was hired more for, I wasn't consistently hired, period. But the things that I did get hired to do were more comedic in nature.
And it wasn't like even right when you got to Chicago, you were in Second City, right? There were a few years. And then how do you, right? So you become in the orbit, and then a few more years before you're in the main troupe, right?
Yeah. No, it takes a while. I took classes there and auditioned and was in a touring company. So, there was a process involved there.
And you also ultimately began teaching there as well, right?
I did. That's where I met my wife.
Yes. Can I ask you to share that story?
Sure. I thought, wow, she's really cute, and she's from Boston.
She was one of your students in that class. Yeah.
Yeah. And it sounds a lot creepier than
it is. No,
you know,
no,
she's 4 years younger than I am,
right.
And, you know, we're all adults, and I did nothing irresponsible in class. It was funny because I remember teaching the class, and I thought, wow, she's way out of my league. You know, there's no way that's going to happen. But I thought she was so funny and so smart. But whenever I was teaching class, she'd look at me with this completely dour expression. I thought, oh, and and she hates me. And later on, I found out that she liked me, but she was just trying not to let on anything. And she also worked across the street at the restaurant bar right across from Second City. So after shows, because I was teaching and I was working on the main stage, I'd go over and I didn't really drink, so I'd go over and have a Diet Coke and sit at the bar, and she was the bartender. And the first time I asked her out, I mean, it took months for me to ask her out. And finally, I got up the guts to say something like, you know, if I ever asked anybody out, it would probably be a person just like you. It was like just hemming and hawing and all around. And she was exactly the same way. She said, you know, if I were to say yes to somebody, it would be a person like you who might be asking me. I mean, we beat around the bush so much. And then finally, we kind of admitted that we liked each other and actually went out on a date.
Some of the other folks who you were at Second City with have gone on to other exciting things, including one Stephen Colbert.
Never heard of him.
The one that the sketch that I keep coming across and reading about that time in your lives was the one about a pair of waiters who are nauseated by food.
Yeah.
Was that sort of your biggest hit in terms of collaborations with him?
That was my audition for the Dana Carvey show.
Would come after.
It was Waiters Who Were Nauseated by Food was on the Dana Carvey show.
Oh, it wasn't a Second City thing.
No, it wasn't a Second City piece. We both auditioned. We flew out to Los Angeles. This was after we both left Second City.
So we're talking mid-90s at this point.
Exactly. Yeah. So we were both auditioning, and when I auditioned, I did it as a solo thing. I thought, boy, I don't do stand-up, and I had to come up with some characters and do some bits. So I thought it might be funny to do a podiatrist who is nauseated by feet. And so I used, someone in the audition, and I'd examine their feet and then dry heave and not be able to contain myself. And then once we got on the show, I pitched that we do this waiter thing as a tandem bit. That's with Stephen and I.
So the way if I have the chronology right, your wife, I guess, what year did she become your wife? Maybe she was still your girlfriend.
95.
So that year, she winds up on SNL.
Yeah.
So you guys moved to New York. First of all, did you ever go out for SNL? A lot of Second City people seem to have auditioned.
I never got to audition.
Okay. So now the first big audition would have been this Dana Carvey show audition. Is it Robert Smigel that was the person that recruited you guys for that?
Yeah, he was the executive producer. He was the one in charge. And Dana, and Dana were executive producing it. That whole thing was a dream. I'd never been on a TV show before. And that group of people, Robert Carlock, and the list of writers was just an incredible gathering. Louis C.K. and Charlie Kaufman was a staff writer. So it's just to name a few. And Stephen and I both got jobs on it. And we knew almost instantly that it wasn't going to be on the air for very long. But we, we knew we were on borrowed time, but it was really fun while we did it.
So it lasted 8 episodes on ABC. Dana Carvey has said, quote, "It was probably the most bizarre variety show in the history of American television," close quote. So I guess maybe a little ahead of its time. But your comedic persona at that time was also very different than the one that people came to associate with you later on. You were more of a loud, yelling kind of guy at that point, right?
Probably, yeah. I think I did a lot of... I remember we did this one scene called The Stupid Pranksters, and they would pull pranks on people that really didn't affect that person in any adverse way. But we would think it's hilarious. Right. This old lady hires us to shovel her driveway, shovel the snow, and we shovel it, and then we run away without collecting our $5. And she comes out with the money, and she doesn't understand. And it cuts to us in a car laughing hysterically. And it was mostly about that moment where we're just laughing hysterically. Right. So yeah, it was pretty broad and pretty loud stuff.
Different. So when that show was canceled, it sounds like you and your wife moved to LA. I guess it was partly to start a family, partly to see what you could now audition for more, maybe more screen opportunities to audition for in LA. And it does sound like there were a number of times in the years, well before The Office, where you were going out for something, it got a little bit off the ground, And then, you know, for one reason or another, it died. And I wonder how soul crushing that is when, you know, you're just waiting for sort of a break to happen.
You know, it wasn't soul crushing because just the fact that I got that close or that something did get a little bit off the ground, I've always felt that the success is incremental and it's just the rungs of a ladder. And as long as you're not falling off the ladder, you're doing fine. Right. If you're on the ladder, you're okay. And so I never felt, you know, I was also always sad when something didn't work out. But you get to know pretty quickly that that's just the way it goes. And things that stick or things that happen over long periods of time are few and far between. But just to get that chance, just to get in the door, just to even get an audition, you know, that to me at the time was really the success.
It sounds like one thing that was going on for a number of years, starting probably around then, was something that introduced your voice to people, if not your face. How did you and Steven become the ambiguously gay duo?
That was Robert Smigel. Yeah. We started that on the Dana Carvey show.
Right. So these segments that a bunch of times on SNL, and just he was Ace, you were Gary. Is that yeah?
That's right.
So that you had a presence on SNL.
That's right. Yeah. Well, again, it started, we did a few for the Dana Carvey show. And then when Robert would also do things for SNL and he was a contributor. So he brought that and Lauren, you know, put those on from time to time.
All right. So in 1998, Jon Stewart replaces Craig Kilborn at the Daily Show. Colbert goes over there. And how then do you wind up joining them?
Colbert called me up. There were some openings. I think a couple of their correspondents had moved on, and he called me up and said, is it something you'd be interested in trying out for? Because I want to throw your name in the hat. I'd like to talk to the producers here about you. And I was living in LA at the time, and I wasn't working on anything, and I said, sure, you know, I'd give that a shot. And so they gave me, I think my first field piece was about like a conspiracy theorist who believed that people were being kidnapped at Disneyland and were becoming mind control slaves to a race of lizard people. So that was my first. And I'll be honest, I thought, I don't know if I'm cut out to do this. This is not. Because it's such a weird hybrid of things. Yes. Because you're pretending. At the time, The Daily Show wasn't really on the map. And, mm-hmm. and people didn't know who these people were. Mm-hmm. You know, you could go out and you just hear The Daily Show and you would assume, oh, it's a news program mm-hmm. on some cable network, and didn't necessarily know that it was a comedy show. So you could kind of get away with pulling the wool over right. people's eyes. But even that part of it was a little strange to me because I didn't want to do anything that was mean-spirited. Right. And I very quickly had to figure out how to make my character the butt of the joke as opposed to the people that I was interviewing.
Well, it sounds like there was even maybe a specific turning point where that became clear to you that you wanted to shift that dynamic. Was there something with the Klingon conference?
You know, that wasn't. No, I loved the Klingon conference because it's, again, and it was an easy thing to do to kind of make myself the buffoon in these pieces because that's a perfect example of a group of people, and they're quirky, and it's essentially a group of people who love to get together and speak Klingon. There is an actual language, and they all learn it, and they dress up as Klingons, and they get together once a year or so, right. and they speak Klingon to each other. And I kind of loved it because they turned out to be a really wonderful group of people and sweet and kind and generous to one another. And why make fun? They're not hurting anyone. Mm-hmm. And I just thought a really sweet, heartfelt thing. And so it's easy as sort of the buffoon investigative reporter to come into this world and you make yourself the ass, and it's certainly not them.
And you essentially created a bit of a backstory for your own guy that you would be on the show. This was a guy that had failed at or had some, for whatever reason, fallen right. from grace.
Right. Yeah, that was sort of in the back of my mind. Like that he was maybe for a brief moment on the national scene and then had been relegated to this terrible, crappy cable news program. And, you know, I had all this backstory in my mind about this tortured correspondent having a chip on his shoulder.
So after, I guess, 5-6 years, what was it that motivated you in 2004 to leave the show, move back to the West Coast, where you then promptly wound up playing a few other fake newsmen in your first movies?
That's
but
right.
What was the impetus?
The impetus was comfort, really. I started to feel too comfortable in the job. It was a great, great job. And my wife, Nancy, had become a correspondent, and we'd just had a baby, and it was a family. Loved working with John, and the writing was excellent. But at the same time, I just felt that maybe it would be best to move on. Because I tend to like to shake things up a little bit and not become complacent and see what else is out there and just make a leap of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we did.
And so you wind up back out there, and it seems like your first major step into the world of film was as this character, Evan Baxter, who you would play multiple times. The first time in Bruce Almighty, 2003, you were, fun fact, still credited as Stephen Carell in the credits.
Right.
And to remind people, you basically stole the movie in the scene where Jim Carrey, as this godlike character, starts controlling your behavior in that scene on the air. But it was my understanding that when you showed up at the premiere, you didn't think you were still in the movie.
I didn't know either way. I was just a small supporting character, so you never know. And I tend to be a glass half empty sort of person. I think to what you were saying before about the anticipation of things that fail or it doesn't happen. I think if you guard against that, and maybe that's a terrible way to go through life, but if you sort of limit your own expectations, it's helpful. And I did that with that movie.
Right.
And I thought, maybe I'm not in this. I'll go. It'll be fun. Maybe you'll see me.
Right.
I'll be in the background of one scene.
And then you saw that scene. What did you think?
It was weird to see yourself. You know, having never seen yourself on a movie screen, it's a little disconcerting for starters. A little crazy. Like, oh my, wow, that's what I look like, huh? That's a tough pill to swallow.
Well, that got the ball rolling. But I've got to ask you about another one that I think early on sort of expanded on what was initially almost like a cult following, and that is, of course, Brick, the simple-minded weatherman in Anchorman. This one, you've said, was the real game changer in that it introduced you to McKay and Ferrell, right? I mean, why was that so important? Even if the part was, you know, not a leading one yet or whatever, why was that the one that you say it really everything else stems from?
Well, just getting the chance to be a part of that movie, it was pure joy. Those guys, I can't imagine having more fun than the four of us had filming that. And I'd known Adam from Second City.
Right.
Not well. You know, we were in different casts, but we knew each other from back then. And then he was a writer on SNL when my wife was there. So we'd been sort of in the same circle for a while, but I'd really never worked with him before. And
except for one time I heard there was a little bit of a stunt thing where you came out of the audience.
Oh, yeah. My wife, well, he and my wife were in a touring company at Second City, and they were doing a show up in Madison, Wisconsin. And I went to visit Nancy while she was there. And Adam planted me in the audience and said, we're going to have you come up on stage and do an improv.
Right.
And people in the audience will just think that you're like a member of the audience,
mm-hmm.
but then we're going to be really, really mean to you. and so I pretended like I was just a guy from the audience, and then I was trying to improvise with them, and they just dragged me over the coals, and you could feel the audience turning on the cast. They were so mad that the cast was being so mean to this innocent member of the audience. And even when we said, "We're just kidding, I'm in a cast down in Chicago,"
they were gone.
Couldn't get him back. But Brick was, that character had almost no lines when we started. And every day Adam would say, at the end of the scene, just say something. It doesn't even matter. And to have that, you know, that freedom to just play around and kind of say whatever. And I remember Paul Rudd and I were just sitting around between takes, And we started singing Afternoon Delight because we'd heard it on the radio recently. And we were picking out these harmonies, and the two of us were, and we weren't thinking of putting it into the movie. And Adam walked by and heard us and said, "Can you guys learn 4-part harmony of that by tomorrow?" And we said, "Yes." And so we put it in the movie. And
so
we
that and we shot Lamp and just, all the other.
See, that's what it was. It was such just a mixed bag of stuff. Yeah. And Adam, that's the way he loves to work. It's haphazard. It's all over the place. But there's definitely a method to the madness. He is a genius for casting a wide net and then boiling it down to the best components of what it is.
So Judd Apatow was around there because what? He was a producer of that.
He was a producer on that.
And he, on the set, took a particular interest in finding out what if you had any ideas for future projects, or what was that?
Yes, he said towards the end of shooting Anchorman, he asked if I had any ideas for anything. And I met with him once we finished shooting, and I spent about an hour pitching him this idea that I'd been thinking about. And we went back and forth, and it was a decent idea, and he liked it, and we were going to noodle with it a little bit more. And as I was getting up, I said, "Oh, there's this other thing." And I pitched him 40-Year-Old Virgin. And he sat back down and said, "Now that I could sell tomorrow."
Right.
And he pretty much did. Like that next week, he was talking to a Universal executive and gave them a really quick soft pitch on it, and they said, "Yes, we'll buy that
with you as the lead."
Yeah. And he is director.
That's a big vote of confidence, because you had not yet, obviously, from what we've talked about, played a lead, right?
No, I think in both of us, because we were both fairly unproven,
right?
And so they just liked the idea, and they went with it.
In the meantime, before I think anything to do with 40-Year-Old Virgin was really going, you go out for an NBC pilot not called The Office, right? And you get that show. Meanwhile, they're interested in you for The Office, but there's now this juggling that has to happen. What was going on as far as you knew at that time?
I didn't know anything.
Okay.
I just knew I was on this one show, but then it became apparent pretty early on that it wasn't panning out.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started hearing there's this other show that they might be interested in you for. It was NBC as well.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really, I'm so oblivious, and I continue to be, really. So I just luckily was able to audition for The Office.
And so this, just to, I guess, set the scene, you're going to go in for an audition for a show, no laugh track, no background music, documentary style, and following in the footsteps of a very acclaimed British version with Ricky Gervais. Were you at all intimidated by any of those things, or did you not really even know much about the Gervais version at that time?
I didn't know much, apart from what Paul Rudd had told me. And I remember I told Paul that I was going to audition for this, and he said, "Oh, don't do it. Don't do it. You can't. It's going to fail. There's no way. There's no way an American version will even live up a little bit to the British version." So that made me a little scared. But the good thing is, because of that comment, I decided not to watch any of the British version, because I thought, okay, my best shot at this is if I don't know anything about that show and just create what I see as this guy, as opposed to doing an impression of Ricky. Because, you know, subsequently I've seen a lot of what he did on that show, and it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And there's no way I could have replicated that. So I thought the best course of action is to just try to generate something that at least felt original to me.
You get this part, the American version of David is now Michael Scott, office manager at Dunder Mifflin's Scranton branch. 149 episodes it ended up lasting for you, but after the first season, a lot of things changed. The people, I think, forget that in the first season, he was maybe a bit of a meaner guy, I guess you could say. And also, you were still not particularly well-known until 40-Year-Old Virgin came out, and that was in between, I think, the two seasons. So how close did it come to not going beyond that first season?
I think it was pretty close. I think it was Kevin Riley at NBC, as I remember it, and as I know it, he's the one who saved it. I think he was our champion at NBC, and he put his career on the line to a certain extent by saying, I have faith in this. this one's on me. I think this could turn into something great. It just needs a little time. So we're always very thankful to him for keeping us on the air.
And you originally, I guess the first contract was for 3 years, then you extended through 7. What's it like to play one character over that long a period of time and then have to say goodbye to that character? I know there are many things in between which I'll ask you about, but I mean, just the idea of throughout that period playing one, coming back to this character, it was a different experience than anything up to that point, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Well, I think you have to go into a show like that assuming that it's going to go for a while. Maybe that's not good advice to give to people, but I thought acting-wise, even that first season, which was different than some of the subsequent seasons, even then, I think we all had it in our minds that it wasn't just the first season of us doing the show. It's the first season of this documentary. So that was always what we were thinking about. And I thought in terms of Michael Scott, well, this is who he is the first season. He's a little more abrasive. He's trying a little too hard because he's never been on TV before. He's never experienced a camera crew. And I felt if this is going to go for a while, he has to start at one point and has to evolve over the years. Mm-hmm. Because if this does go to a second and third year, he's going to become more confident in his camera savvy. Mm-hmm. And you're going to get a more in-depth picture of how he actually interacts. He's going to relax. He'll probably reveal more about himself personally further down the line when he starts to forget about the cameras. So there was, at least in my mind, a method to the madness in terms of the arc. I really saw it as an arc. And around season 4, I thought season 7 is going to be it for me, regardless of where the show mm-hmm. is. Because I saw the arc of where I thought Michael should end up. Because at a certain point, I figure he would grow enough as a human being that he didn't need the camera crew and he didn't need the celebrity and that he had what he wanted out of life, which was a family and love. So I saw that as sort of the perfect execution of that beginning to end and all the foibles and weirdness that transpire in the middle.
And in the meantime, I guess, as we were talking about earlier, the 40-year-old version's coming together where you're going to now carry a movie for the first time. You and Apatow co-wrote it. Universal is making it. So it gets going. But even as dailies are starting to come in, they were not sold on you still, right?
No. They shut us down after week one.
For what reason?
Because I looked like a serial killer. because they watched dailies. And all we were shooting that first week was me wearing this weird bike helmet in a little windbreaker on this really weird looking bike riding around the city. That was like all day one dailies.
Right.
Like, okay, that's
make
a little
a terrible
weird
mistake.
And then day two was like me walking down the street and looking weirdly at women and being weirded out by you know, sexually explicit ads on the side of buses. And they couldn't put it any context on it. I mean, it just looked weird. And they called us in. I remember Judd, we should have seen it. And Judd walked in and said, "We have to shut down." Like, what? Universal would like to talk to us. So we just done. Everybody went home. We went to Universal. And we kind of had to talk our way back into shooting. This was on a Friday.
How did you digest the complaint?
We didn't fight it. We just said, okay, you know, we will do the best that we can. They put, you know, I think they just needed to see more of what it was going to be and start to see the heart of it and start to see the relationships. And I think it was just again, we were completely unproven. They didn't know what we were up to. Or even when we went into test screenings, I don't think they held much hope for this movie until it started to test screen.
Right.
And then people started responding positively to it. But to their credit, it was a leap of faith.
Right.
Like, why would you make this movie? I remember at the time I had made it And I went back for a high school reunion, and people asked what I was up to. And I said, I just did this movie called 40-Year-Old Virgin. And I could see their eyes rolling back in their head. Oh, that sounds great.
Right.
And I could feel their pity.
Oh, man.
Like, oh, this guy, what a terrible career he's got ahead of him. Just didn't sound good.
When you say 40-Year-Old Virgin to somebody today, I think for most people, the first thing that comes to mind is the chest waxing scene. It's just instantly associated. I wanted to just quickly ask you the execution of that. I heard one take, five cameras, real chest hair.
Real? Oh, yeah. Yeah. That, I remember Judd and I was driving to a writing session, and we were talking about, we wanted to do this makeover sequence, sort of a Pretty Woman makeover sequence, and like how he's going to glow up. And I thought, well, I think a chest waxing might be fun. But I pitched to Judd that we really do it, and we do it real time. Because in my mind, it wasn't so much, I didn't think my character was the funny aspect of that scene. My idea was that the three guys watching, their honest reaction to the fact that I was having my hair pulled out,
right.
That to me would be really funny. Because there's no way you can act that. You can't create that. Romney, at one point, while we were shooting, you'll see he leaves because he can't take it. It's so disturbing to him. He had to walk out of the scene.
And your little exclamations things that you're yelling are totally just in the moment improv
There were some, we really didn't know where it was going or what it was going to be. And Judd, I mean, he framed it so beautifully, and he was smart in the way that he had all of those cameras. Cause obviously we couldn't do more than one take cause it's not going to go back for a while.
No.
But if you look closely, you can see blood coming to the surface.
Yeah.
It was, and the woman who did it.
I was going to say, they're hilarious too. Just look at them.
Well, she said on her resume that she knew how to do waxing. But I...
Not so sure.
That's like, also, I can drive a standard and I own my own tux.
Right. So the movie opens, $177 million worldwide. Suddenly you're a movie star. Can you talk about the pros and cons of that, just coming out of that weekend? On the one hand, I imagine, you're now poised to have a lot more money, a lot more opportunities. On the other hand, you can't walk down the street the same way that you could before, I would think. Maybe it wasn't that quick. But what was your experience with that post 40-Year-Old Virgin moment?
I can still walk down the street pretty easily.
Really? It's,
yeah. I don't cause much of a hubbub. So that really didn't change.
Okay, good.
It was sort of incremental. I didn't feel any different. There wasn't... I'll tell you the biggest difference. After that, I went in, they called me in because they were doing this redo of Get Smart. And I thought, wow, I'm in the running to play Maxwell Smart. That's pretty cool. So I went for a meeting what I thought was an audition over at Warner Brothers. And I had my little briefcase with my picture and resume. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sent any sides, so I was thinking, are they going to have us improvise? Are they going to just show sides once we get there? And I didn't know. So I was ushered into this conference room, and it was like the mucky mucks of Warner Brothers sitting around this big square conference room table. And I thought, this is a weird place to audition. And I couldn't wrap my head around what this was. And the meeting started, and he said, thanks for coming in. We'd love you to play Maxwell Smart. And they start talking about the movie. And I literally had my hand on my picture and resume, and I'm trying to be cool, putting it back into my briefcase. Because I thought I was...
Never
been offered, just offered a part.
Yeah.
And so that was the biggest change to me, was wow, I actually didn't have to read for this. So,
and did it also seem now that you had the, I guess you would say, financial security, not if you maybe you already felt that way, but certainly to go and do little indies like A Little Miss Sunshine, which was just a year after 40-Year-Old Virgin, to go and do something like that where you had to like the material, because otherwise, apart from you, it's directorial debut of Dayton and Ferris. It wasn't on anyone's radar that much. So I think your involvement probably helped to make that one happen.
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, I thought that, there were so many great actors in that. I felt like I was the lucky piece of that puzzle. That was one of those happy accidents. You know, being able to be invited into that.
Because Arkin was a hero of yours.
Arkin is, Alan Arkin is my idol. Mm-hmm. I mean, I never got to meet Peter Sellers. Mm-hmm. And Alan Arkin is, I feel the same way. Mm-hmm. And I've been able to work with him a few times. Yeah. And I admire him so much. So that was a big thing for me, being able to work with him. And we all read this script. I mean, we've talked about it later, the members of the cast, and it just seemed right. There wasn't anything that any of us would want to change. And I met Valerie and Jonathan, the directors, and they were thoughtful and smart, and it just seemed like such a great, great thing. And it felt right while we were doing it, and kind of effortless.
Wound up with Best Picture Oscar nomination, so I think people agreed. Another one that people really responded to you very strongly in that same year was Dan in Real Life with Peter Hedges. So then it seems like for the years after, ever since, it's been a back and forth between these intimate indies and some of the larger scale comedies or animated movies with the Despicable Me movies. Do you have any sort of equation in your own mind about I'm going to do a small one and a big one every year, I'm going to go back and forth, or is it just truly you judge it by what comes at you?
It's what comes at me. It's sort of luck of the draw, unless there are people working behind the scenes that are laying it all out in a beautiful way that I'm not aware of. But I, you know, like Little Miss Sunshine or Dan in Real Life, there are things that just came about that piqued my interest. And I hate to be too aw shucks about the whole thing, but every time I'm offered something like that, I think, wow, how did I get so lucky? How did this work out to my favor? Because, you know, when Bennett Miller called up about Foxcatcher, that blew my mind. You know, Bennett Miller?
No.
How could I possibly be on that guy's radar?
Well, we're definitely going to come to that one specifically. But I first have to ask you, because it sounds like maybe the moment where that, you know, let's see what comes at me slightly shifted was you started your own production company, which mm-hmm. is something, you know, sometimes happens. And in your case, it's interesting because that's, I guess, the first time where the ball is really truly in your court to decide what you want to be a part of, what you want to try to develop. It sounds like one of the first, maybe the first thing that came out of this production company was Crazy Stupid Love. Why was that? I mean, obviously you were validated by the critical and commercial response, but why was that what you wanted to do?
I thought it was well written. I just liked it. I thought it was funny. I could see it. And it was exciting to be in a position to find the directors and find the cast and shape it the way I envisioned it could proceed. And, you know, getting Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling, Julianne Moore, like all of these fantastic actors that, again, like, wow, you want to be in this?
Right.
it's crazy. Marissa Tomei. And they've all become friends of mine. And I remember one day we were shooting and we were sort of running out of time for one scene. And then it was raining and then we had to move on. And I realized that, oh, I'm the guy who has to make the decision. Like I was, you know, I'm happily acting and the directors are directing. And the directors came and said, well, what do? We haven't finished. And I said, okay, we're moving on. And it was such a strange feeling to have that sort of authority to say, okay, I guess we're going to make do with whatever that was and try to get to the rest of it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's an added responsibility for sure. But also it was exciting, you know, to help usher it and push it in the way that I thought best.
When it's not a movie that you are behind, how much does the identities of your potential co-stars factor into whether or not to do something? I mean, I would imagine if ever that was a consideration, it might have been with Hope Springs, where you're with Tommy Lee Jones and Meryl Streep.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's you just do that.
Right.
You get a call and you, yes. I don't even have to read it.
That's, right.
And you also, people like that, you also think, well, if they're doing it, then there's a reason to do it. Right. You know,
save some of the
I might not have taste, but they definitely do. So it's nice to follow. You know, and same with directors. Like if a director has a specific idea and you've liked that person's work, or you've just liked a writer in general, you try to partner with people like that that you respect, and you respect the opinions of good actors who, you know, you can sense whether something has a potential or not.
Well, a year after, so Crazy Stupid Love is 2011, Hope Springs is 2012. 2013, you did a movie where it was, you're playing a character unlike any other character I think we'd ever seen you play before in The Way, Way Back, basically a cocky asshole, for lack of a better word. And it was interesting. I wonder, you know, did you feel that that was a bit of a risk? I know you initially turned it down. I don't know if that was why, but I, on the other hand, you've got Faxon and Rash who are improv guys like you, I think, out of the Groundlings instead of Second City. But, you know, essentially from a sensibility point of view, it would make sense to want to work with those guys. But on the other hand, you've cultivated at that point a bit of a screen persona, and now you're going to sign up to blow it up.
Yeah.
Was that scary?
No, I wasn't worried about that. You know, screen persona, I think people ultimately can separate. I trust that they can, that's exactly what it is. It's just different personas. And if people get locked into one, that's on them, mm-hmm. You know. And I only turned it down at first because it was shooting during the summertime. And summer is generally a time I just spend with family and carve out that, you know, with my kids and my wife. And the only reason it worked was because they ended up shooting where we were spending the summer. And so I could kind of...
That night. That's
it
nice.
Was great. I mean, it worked. It was like we had a beach holiday.
Right.
And I also shot a movie. Right. So it was... But no, I wasn't intimidated. I embraced the idea of playing somebody who was less than nice and generous. Human,
mm-hmm.
But you know, I always tend to think of somebody who's just damaged in some way. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why he is an asshole.
Yeah.
And without putting too fine a point on it, I thought, well, there's a human being there to be played, and I like the way it was written. I thought that was an underappreciated movie. I thought Sam Rockwell was great in that movie.
And you were back with Toni Collette again from Little Miss Sunshine, and
yeah.
And it wasn't Allison Janney also.
Fantastic.
Yeah, great.
Again, just this really great cast of people.
Yeah. So in a way, it was a stepping stone towards the next one a year later, which is what you started to bring up a moment ago about Bennett Miller and Foxcatcher, where a lot of people were taken aback, sort of caught off guard to see you playing a out-and-out dramatic part. Was it a matter of having a hunger to do drama and actively, you know, being on the hunt for something that fit that description? Or was it just, again, sort of totally out of the blue and then you just couldn't avoid it in this case?
Totally out of the blue.
Yeah.
Nothing that I had earmarked, nothing that I was looking for. Again, just a strange aligning of the planets. That one I didn't see coming. And I certainly didn't see. I'd met Bennett Miller before, mm-hmm. but I never envisioned working with him.
Because he's associated with movies that were different than the kind that you had been making?
Yeah. And I don't know if you know him very well, but in meeting him, I thought, he scares the crap out of me. He's a very intimidating guy. Yeah. To first, when you meet him,
yeah,
he's very intelligent and he's an artist, you know, and I was intimidated, and I was even surprised when we first got together to have lunch and talk about the part. It felt a bit like a prank. Like, why, how in a million years do you see me in this role?
Did he tell you?
He did. And I think part of the impetus for the call was that it sort of leaned into what my public persona is or was at that time. Mm-hmm. And that it was essentially, here's this guy and he's quirky, but you never expect him to do what he ends up doing. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a part of the component, was that it was unexpected. It was not like you think you have a handle on who this character is, and then they they turn out to be something different or beyond what you thought. But yeah, it did come out of the blue. It wasn't anything that I was looking to do necessarily.
That was a part that required or that you gave intense preparation. I've read about all the literary research, the visual research, the contacting people who knew and dealt with the real DuPont. Then you have all the prosthetics. What did you make of working in that way for, I guess, the first time, probably the first time playing a real person?
Yeah, I think it was. Aside from Brick.
Who can be found at which station?
Yeah. It's actually, I've gone to some local stations and they always say, that guy's our Brick. Like, see that one over there? That's Brick.
That's him. Yeah.
Yeah, it was different. I'd never done any sort of prosthetic makeup before, and that, just getting used to what that process entails. There's a responsibility to playing a real person, and you know, you try not to comment on whoever you're playing. I didn't go in thinking, oh, this is a horrible person. You just start with, gosh, this sounds so actory, but I tried to start with the fact that here's a real guy who has had these real experiences. And the more I learned about him and his childhood, and you extrapolate and you do your best to cobble together a sense of who that person might have been. But it's really just a best guess.
And was it your sense during the making of the movie that things were going pretty well from your point of view, or did you have to hear that from others to know that it had worked?
None of us had any clue. I remember at the end of a long day, Mark Ruffalo and I got on an elevator together and we were quiet. And I turned to him and said, this is either like going to work or it's going to end all of our careers. And he said, he was thinking exactly the same thing. You know, we're doing these characters that are unlike anything any of us have done. And, you know, he's walking around like Dave Schultz and I've got this other whole demeanor happening, and we were completely committed to it. But at the same time, we had no idea whether it was going to feel truthful, and we just didn't know.
So that being the case, can you explain how it felt to have this movie, to be there for the movie's premiere at Cannes, to see the reviews that came in, and then especially on the morning of Oscar nominations?
Oh, I will never forget the morning of Oscar nominations. Because, you know, I didn't really think that was going to happen. But I will admit, I woke up and I watched. I wanted to see what was going to happen. So I got out of bed and I snuck downstairs. I didn't want to wake up my wife. So I went down to our family room and I was watching TV. And my name flashed up. And I, like, stood up and I started to run upstairs to wake up Nancy, and she had been watching in our bedroom. So she was on her way downstairs. So we met, and we didn't want to wake up the kids. Right. So we're standing on our stairs, just like hugging, jumping up and down, but silently. I will never forget it. It was a really exciting moment.
And do you feel that it was in any way a turning point in terms of the career, in terms of now people? Maybe the performance itself would have done this, but just even if there wasn't the Oscar nomination, but the idea that now people could imagine you in roles like the one we're coming to here, the most recent, do you think it was a shifter of the way people saw you?
Oh, yes. Now I demand respect. it's all changed.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if it, I didn't necessarily feel it.
It's not like you started, you know, refusing to work with your old friends. The next movie was Adam McKay with right. The Big Short back at the Oscars.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It was a really fun moment, but you can't put too much stock in the kind of impact it might have on a career.
But it is interesting in terms of then playing people who really existed. For The Big Short, it's a different name, your character, Mark Baum, than the guy who inspired him, but that's essentially modeled after another person who lived, right?
Yeah, Steve Yzerman.
Then you did Battle of the Sexes, obviously Bobby Riggs, who I think you'd said you remembered seeing that, the Battle of the Sexes as a kid.
Yeah, I remember it vividly.
Wow. Last Flag Flying, was that modeled after an actual person?
It wasn't. No.
Okay. But it could have been. I'm sure there are plenty of guys that...
I thought a lot about my dad playing really? That part. Yeah, he's a World War II vet. And wow. There's something about his demeanor that I felt lent itself to that. He's a very humble guy, but with a real internal fortitude. And who went through some incredibly tough moments fighting through France and Germany, and which I didn't find out about until I was an adult. But, you know, here's this really kind, open-hearted soul, but to know about the terrible things that he experienced, eye-opening.
Yeah, that was. I think that's an underappreciated performance of yours. I know that people should go and check it out. But that brings us to the most recent and not only real person that you've played, but I guess most recent released movie, just this past Friday or this coming Friday, mm-hmm. with Beautiful Boy. How did you first hear about it, and were you immediately on board? It's got to be a dark headspace to commit yourself to for a little while.
I was immediately on board after I read the script. I thought it was well written. I thought it was relevant and timely and important. It's an important message, I think. It's an important subject matter. You know, you never want to do a movie because of that. You don't want a movie to lecture people or to be just purely informative. I felt beyond the fact that it is a topic that exists in our world that, you know, that people deal with all the time, that the movie itself, that the themes were love and family and hope, and those all appeal to me. And I relate. You know, I have two kids and basically the same age as the character in the film, and it's a terrifying prospect to think about your kids going through something like that. So I related to it in a real personal level as well.
In terms of prep, you had not only the two memoirs that the father and son had written that you could consult on top of the script, but also the two authors and people who lived through this themselves. Was there anything particularly useful for your performance that you were able to get from talking to them and actually, you know, hearing firsthand about their experience?
Just the kindness that they imbue. They're both... You know, it's interesting. It seems like such a dark movie, and obviously it is, and dark subject matter to be sure. But the two of them are such light people. They have such generosity of spirit and are fun and funny. So I think that's what Timothy and I gleaned from getting to know both of them, is that they came out the other side of this ordeal with their spirit intact and so generous. The fact that they even allowed this movie to be made, that they trusted all of these strangers to interpret it to a film, I take my hat off to them. There's a leap of faith there and a courage that I really admire.
There are a lot of very moving moments in the film, in their story, whether it's when your character first goes to the addiction specialist who kind of makes him aware of how unlikely it is that the son will come out of this, to you having to practice some tough love on the son, turning him away essentially, to the one in the diner, I guess it is, where you're realizing the extent of what he's in. I just wonder, was there one that stands apart from the others for you that was maybe the most challenging to act?
I think the most challenging would be a scene in which the character has to turn his back on his son, because it goes against every fiber of your being as a parent. The idea of, I mean, it's hard enough to say no to your kids, but to say, I'm not helping you anymore because it's not helping, it's almost beyond my comprehension as a dad. And it's real. It's what he did. It's what this family went through. So I think that moment was probably the most daunting and the one that I feared.
Yeah. Just a few weeks ago, I was sitting an aisle over from, it was you and Timothy and then the real chefs and a whole bunch of people that worked on this movie at the Toronto International Film Festival. There was the world premiere at their biggest venue, which is the Roy Thomson Hall. People can be very tough on movies there, or they can let you know that they love it. And I've been going there a long time, and I've seen both, and it can be awkward if it doesn't go your way, and it can be amazing if it does. What was that like for you when, first of all, there were people responded to the movie, then they put the lights on you guys, and it was clear to, suddenly to the audience that not only are you and Timothy there, but also these folks whose story we've just seen. I imagine that was a special one for you guys.
It was. I can't even imagine how it felt for David and Nick to have lived this, to have written books about it, and then to have a film made about your experience is... I know David had to watch the film again that afternoon before the premiere because he'd never seen it with a group of people before. He'd watched it by himself months ago, and he had to see it again and kind of reflect on it once more before he saw it with an audience. Because I, you know, he's a very open guy, and he told me he just didn't know how he would respond. I don't know if you remember, he and Nick came out on stage, and the audience just embraced the fact that they were there, and he had to kind of turn. And I was standing next to him, and I just saw in his face, and I don't think it's revealing too much because it was just a really tender moment, but I saw him taking it in and processing it, and I could tell it just meant so much to him that they were there and that all of these people had shown up to support it, and that you know, all the rest of the people on the stage had done their best to honor their story as well. It was just a really moving moment, and it was very pure. It wasn't one of these contrived, like, and the audience is going to love this part when we trot them out. No, it was really organic and just a lovely moment for the, you know, for all of us, really.
Looking towards the future, I know that we will soon see you in another Adam McKay movie, Vice. Yeah. Yep. You are playing, just to, you know, let people know, Donald Rumsfeld opposite Christian Bale's Dick Cheney. This is 3 years after The Big Short, where you all were together.
It's even funny for you to say, and, you know, Christian Bale is Cheney. I'm like, how, again, like, how did we get from right. A to B here? Like, you know. We're talking about, I work with Bennett Miller and I do this thing, and then I'm, you know, in this movie with Christian Bale and Amy Adams and Sam Rockwell. Like, it's like very heady stuff. I still, even hearing it, I kind of pinch myself.
There's also coming up around the same time as Vice, Welcome to Marwen, which is adapted from a documentary.
Yes. It was a documentary about a man named Mark Hogenkamp who suffered a traumatic brain injury. And as therapy, he created this backyard town, this scale model town inhabited by essentially G.I. Joes and Barbie dolls. And it was his art installation. He would take pictures and create this world for himself as a way of coping with his post-traumatic stress. And so that's the documentary, and that's the real life person. And Robert Zemeckis has taken this and expanded this world to include the fantasy world and the real world, and it travels between the two. It's
that's
crazy.
Exciting. I mean, I guess he can certainly do the blend of VFX and real life as well as anybody.
Yeah, so. He's the guy.
Awesome. Last question is, anything you can tell us about your thoughts about what people are constantly badgering you about as far as, will there ever be, you know, now that everybody's rebooting everything, will there ever be a Office reboot? And just generally the outlook at the moment.
I don't know. Future, I'm always just looking for the next thing and just want to do, I've talked to Timothy Chalamet about this. We were talking about it the other day. Someone asked, would I want to do like another 40-year-old virgin? Like, we're doing a Q&A with the audience and a 40-year-old virgin type of movie, like another Judd movie or some big raucous comedy, and ask the same question of Timothy. Mm-hmm. And we're at such, you know, he's exploding right now, and he's got all of this stuff going on. And he said, yeah, sure, you know. And what struck me, he said, sure, if it's good. Mm-hmm. And I feel exactly the same way. Absolutely. If I feel like there's some merit to it and it might turn out well. You never know. Even
does that
when you
apply
think
to Office as well, or
oh, the
done?
Office. You know, Here's my idea. Mm-hmm. I think the Office cast should get together and reboot Cheers. And I'll play Sam. Wouldn't that be better?
Interesting.
I think it would be better.
Well, whatever it is, very excited to see. And thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/TheRace. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply.